Accession number 26550, Reel 7.
Mr. McAvoy, Reel 7. Now, what about this posting to HMS Wolf thing? Tell me about that. Where was she?
She was in Pompey Dockyard. 26,000 ton of ex-merchant ship that had been turned into submarine depots yet. But the gods were on my side. The commander was the first skipper I had, Mansfield, who shanghaied to me and two others. He shanghaied us and put us on plum jobs. Gunny office, regulating petty officers' office, and what was the other? Oh, on a skimming dish driver.
And what were you put on?
The first I was on the skimming dish.
What's that?
It's a boat. About 16, 17 feet long.
A motorboat?
Yeah. Could get about 23, 4 knots out of it.
And what were your duties?
You looked after it like a baby. Scrubbed it, polished it. Because he had a critical eye and he would not say anything if it was all right. But as soon as he found one little fault, he would say.
Why was it a good job?
Oh, it was a plum job.
Why?
Because you were your own boss. You'd done no other duties other than that. But you were on call for him. He would say to you today, I won't be needing you tomorrow. So you knew you could get him on the show tomorrow. But if he said, you're on call for the next 8 days, you were on call. And you didn't get a little bit of muck on the side or even the rubbing strakes along the side, he was... Same looking at him. And the other two jobs, which you alternated, we alternated.
Now, what were the other? Tell me what they were.
Regulating Petty Officers Office, CRO. they're the police. They're the Navy's police. Well, they were then, all about now.
So, what did it involve, being in his office, or their office?
Well, I was virtually a runner. They don't know, made all the decisions. I just helped out on occasions, like...
In what way?
Helped draw the rum. Or I used to fight like hell to keep that job.
Why?
Because he used to make a bob or two out of it and get a drink on the side.
How?
Easy. When you drew the rum, it used to be a big old fashioned copper pump, and you had to prime it. The only thing you had to prime it with when you first opened the barrel and poured it into the keg. Well, that's the other way around. Out the keg into the barrel. You had to fill the top, and then start to pump it slowly. But you've only got pure rum. At this time, there's nothing added. So then he would do like the chiefs and POs mess. Anyone who was entitled to neaters, well, theirs would come out of it. Then he'd say, right lads, thank you. And he would draw us the PO, myself and himself. That's hot. So then you would add the water with the tears going in as well, believe me. Now, when you'd finished, after all the messes had been through with the Dixies and Fannies, whatever, he would say, right, lads, empty the barrel. So you carefully took it over to your left and you emptied it over to the side. Because behind that combing was a fanny. And he lifted it back up and he'd look in it. Then you put the holes in it and wash it out. And chipped that the other side. We weren't going to mix that with the good stuff. So that's where we made a little bit on the side.
And how much would you get out of that? How much?
Oh, you get at least a pint a day. You didn't get a pint, the RPO would have a govern. Now, the other mess, the other job I got was the CROs. No, the Jonty's messman.
What's that?
Jonty is the master at arms. There was a Jonty and two crushers. The crushers are RPOs, regulate petty officers. But they're the ship's police.
So you were the master at arms messman.
So I carried on pulling the tot with them, and I also got me tot on the mess deck, and I also got me tot in their mess. So I didn't mind the life. Also, I used to serve their grub, wash the dishes, and play solo with them every night. But I wasn't really interested in Malta as a place.
Now, we haven't mentioned that. Well, that's where HMS Wolf went.
She went to Malta.
You joined her at...
First submarine flotilla, Western Mediterranean. Old T-Bolt.
Now, what were you doing as submarine depot?
Well, again, ship. You name it, we carried it for submarines. I mean, for instance, we... I remember frightening the life out of one lad. You know, the thing they were hardest on was smoking. And this lad sitting on this hatch, on the edge of this hatch, looking down, and he's smoking a pipe. This was in Pompey Harbour. And I said, "Do you know what you're doing there, son?" "I know what I'm doing, do you?" I said, "I don't think you do." "Why not?" I said, "Well, you know, there's 360 torpedoes underneath your backside, and you're smoking a pipe." He wouldn't have been off like, but he didn't know that.
So you joined her at Portsmouth and you went out to Malta.
Yeah, round about November.
And that was where you were, the submarine depot, in Malta, in Valletta?
Yeah, in Palatorio Wharf in Friendridge Creek.
And what was the journey out there like, in this big old ship?
It was as daft as a brush. We had a navigator. I can't remember his name. A South African. And he lost us in the Bay of Biscay. The wheel was an old-fashioned yoke steering. Turb you had to handle it. I'd have said it was built in 1925-26. So... I used to volunteer for the masthead lookout, and he had a marvellous lookout. It was a tripod mast, and he went up the front tripod up a ladder, and when he got to the top, there was a room, all glassed in. You never got this on small ships, but with an electric toaster and an electric kettle. So wouldn't you volunteer for that? Yeah, marvellous. All padded seats round it. And you could stand up and have a walk round. And because you were black, the ship was still blacked out then. They couldn't see what you were doing. And as long as you had your ear to the pipe, you could get out of here and have a snooze as well.
And when you got there, what was the routine like in harbour?
Well, again, as I say, I had plum jobs, so... It didn't really bother me, you know.
You were doing these three jobs.
The odd me lads were bits here, bits pieces, you know. their routine never changed. The same monotony, scrub decks, grab a broom and... most of the fellows who went out with us were those... I think it was close to about 180, 200 lads. You know, just joined the Navy. We're being sent out to join various ships, you know, in various ports in the Mediterranean.
So the crew were pretty inexperienced?
Oh, most of them, yeah. Like, we were in Pompey, and the number of pipes that were going on the mess deck was unholy. It was like living in a mist, you know. But as soon as we put outside the harbour and started to get, Johnson tobacco scales you. And I never smoked a pipe in my life anyway, so.
So they got seasick.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. She was a big, unwieldy bitch of a ship. You know, it might have been all right for passenger liners in good cruising weather, in good cruising areas. But to come through the bay in it was an experience of a lifetime. Even a small ship, I found it easier to live with than that. Mind you, you knew the damn thing was going to be stuck against the wall somewhere for the next... couple of 3 years. She actually got paid off in 1957 or 8, when she was in the Clyde.
No, hang on.
They were calling the ghost ship.
But that's not now. That's not in 1945. So what were you doing in Malta? Did you go ashore?
Of course.
What was it like ashore in Malta?
It was a con job. You used to walk down the gulf, as every sailor did. And there'd be ladies showing their thighs and what have you. And all the managers would be standing on the doorstep shouting, "Inside, lads. Blues inside." Blues were India Pale Ale. But actually, they were a manufacturer of Maltese brew with their own labels on. And if you went... if you went in a cafe, it was always steak, eggs and chips. There was no cattle on the island. Very little food was coming, even in 1946. But there was plenty of goats. Well, you didn't care. But it was a nice place. If you were into the history of the place, you know what I mean? I was a wild 21-year-old then. So, I wasn't really interested in the history side of it. Took a terrible battering. You know, the number of buildings that were non-existent when you went there. It's unbelievable.
Apart from the bombing.
Yeah. And they, most of the natives were living in... I can't remember what they called it. It was like a big ditch. Only about 30, 40 feet deep. And they were all living in little caves in the bottom of it. Well, you can't say a blame.
Now, anything happened while you were out there? You were out there till 46, weren't you?
Yeah, I came home about June.
So nothing much happened, I mean, just these routine jobs.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
long well, jobs, but routine all the same.
That's right, yeah.
Now, was that the end of the... How come you came home because that was your end? Your number was up, was it?
Oh, yeah, they said they used to post a list the following rating the Jupiter mob, you know. And if I remember rightly, I had a group number, but I can't tell you what it was now. It was probably someone in the 50s, I'd guess. And he actually came out in July. Was it July? As I say, I'm hazy on these things.
It's all right.
Came out in July, I think.
Do you remember what happened when you were demobilised?
Oh, yeah, £3 a day. Well, you don't know about that, do you?
I don't know what you mean.
They used to pay, they paid us a gratuity, which, again, I think it was about 50 quid, 48, something like that.
That's quite a lot of money then.
It was. Considering we were on 30 by Bob O'Thornay, it was a lot of money. So they put it in a post office savings bank for you. So you couldn't draw it out at one go. You could only draw £3 a day. So, while the leave lasted, and the Navy was sending a few, Bob, you know, final settlements, what have you, and you were having to put it in this bloody account, you could only get £3 a day. Well, mine lasted about 7 weeks or 8 weeks. But I wasn't the only one. All hands were on the same caper, you know, soldiers, Air Force fellas. In a land where you couldn't buy a kid sweets, and you were lucky if you got a pint, and you couldn't buy a bottle of spirits if you like, depending on it.
So what did you spend it? I mean, £3 a
day. Booze, women, loose living, and some were wasted. But I enjoyed life. I was a kid. Again, you know, for the first time in my life, I was free.
Now, what about going back to work, though?
Good question. The money was running out, so I went back. I worked in the flour mills as a kid. And I thought, well, I'll take that part-time. I did get an offer to go and dump in ammo for the Navy. But it was only 15 years. And my father, being an old conservative type of fella, said, take the job you had. He said, if you don't like it, you can always pack it in for something else. But don't take a short-term view of life and take any job, he said, because it's not going to last. Little did he know, 6 years later, he'd be dead and I'd be out. But again, it was just the way life worked out.
So you went back to work at the flour mills. And how did you settle back in there?
Very, very badly.
Now, what were your problems?
None. I took off the next year. I went to
Literally.
I bought a bike. And all the kids
hang on, But what were your problems?
None, I just couldn't settle.
But that's
I was a single fella.
Why couldn't you settle?
I was a single fella. I just wanted to see the world. I'd been halfway around the world and never seen this country. The furthest I ever went as a kid was I think, to Mould, to a boys' camp for a couple of days. Oh, no, and I went to Wrexham once, if I remember rightly. But I enjoyed life. And I was going to enjoy it to the full.
So you couldn't settle at all in a job?
I could have settled into it, I suppose, but I was gone for 6 months, 7 months.
Doing what?
Just wandering, place to place. I went right down the south coast, up the east coast, flung the bike and paid me same fare on, and I was broke. Went back to work and I buggered off again the next year.
At the flour mills?
Yeah. And when...
They could just shut you back then?
Oh, yeah. Good job for dogs them days. And I went to Scotland the next year, as far north as Portsoy, Inverness. Down I was fishing out of Glasgow for Stranraer for 6 weeks. And then I came home, went back to work and met the wife. Fatal. He told him not to marry me because he's not reliable. You never know where the hell he's going to be next year. Oh, never mind it all. Water the bridge, you know.
So when did you get married?
52.
So you were pretty well a wild spirit from 46 to 52.
Oh, of course, yeah. I don't think she was sure about marrying me, but her mother impressed her. Her mother was very impressed with me. She thought I was a lovely lad. That's good, I always joking with her.
Now, did you settle down after that? Were you still working at the flour mill, or what happened?
I stopped in the flour mill till 62, when they made me redundant. And I had, where did I go from there? I went to Satan Isles, where he only lasted 10 months. They made me redundant there. I worked for a few weeks, round this time of the year, at a bottling plant, just further along the road from Tate's. Bents. Then I worked at Bibby's for a few weeks. Then I got a job in a dairy up the road. And I was his blue-eyed boy because I used to turn up every morning. And he wanted me to take jobs beyond my capabilities, quite honestly.
So when did you settle into a job then, or was it...
1964, I went into the post office. And I stayed there till I retired. So it did settle down eventually.
Now, what about your contacts with your old comrades? I mean, did you keep in touch with people from the Foley or the Wolf or the Royal Navy Association?
About 20 years ago, a fellow called Frank B, I gave his address yesterday, rung me up and he said, got a good memory? I said, yeah. He said, tell me about Frank B. I said, big ginger head fella, lives in Fleetwood. He said, you've got me in one. And he said, I was thinking about having a reunion. Have you got any names and addresses? I said, yeah. I said, they won't be new, but I've got some. He said, write them out on a list. Those you can remember. And I wrote 38 names and addresses. And I think about 29 of them clicked, because people have moved on, people have died, whatever. And I put out for five local fellas. Two from Liverpool. Three from Liverpool, one from Connors Quay and one from Wallasey. And I found one of them had died from Liverpool. One had moved to Australia. The one from Runcorn had moved to Wallasey. And the one from Wallasey, this young lady rung me up, she said, you're looking for a fella called Hazelhurst? I said, yeah. She said, what's his name? I said, his name's Norman, but they don't call him that, they call him Snowy. She said, you found him. I said, where is he? Where does he live? Give me his telephone number. Harvest Lane. Just back here. You could basically spit on his house from here.
You'd never seen him?
I'd never seen him. All I knew was that he was on the buses at one stage.
So what about the reunion? What happened with the reunion?
We had quite a few. Well, it was
Were you actually an association, or were you just a reunion?
No, this was a reunion amongst the ship's company. at the last...
What were they like, these reunions?
Great.
What would you do?
Again, bend the elbow, spin a yarn, tell them stories.
And whereabouts would you meet?
In Blackpool. Always the same hotel. It was an old Yorkshireman and his wife, and they were very, very good to us over the years. But he packed in and gave it to his son-in-law, who was a pig with ears. And he put £1.20 on a pint, £1.20 on a whiskey.
So what happened?
He thought we were millionaires, but we weren't.
So what happened to your reunions? Have they stopped now?
They folded, but we still meet at these captain class.
So tell me about the captain class. Why you're a member of that association?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Why is that important to you? I mean, you know, is do your Foley men go to that now?
Does how many was there last year? There was 8, I think, last year.
From the Foley.
I'm not talking about the wives just then. Oh yeah. And I've got all the addresses.
So the Foley now meet as part of the captain class?
That's right, yeah.
Do you get a table together, or...?
Of course. And if you don't, you're drinking together afterwards anyway, you know. Of course, they're getting a bit older than...
Why is it so important to meet your old comrades? I mean, obviously I have to get a guess, but just tell me why, for you, it's important to see the lads.
Well, I like the idea, personally, of keeping in touch. I mean, I'm in touch with one Irish fella in Scotland, who hasn't been over the doorstep in 5 years. Well, he still rings me and I ring him. And it's great to hear his voice.
So the comradeship, the old comradeship, is still important to you?
Oh, it is, yeah. You know, when I go up there, he lives in a place called Kirkliston. I've got that well known. And I walk in a pub and they say, oh, Scouse took you long enough to come back. You know, and I've been going back, since 60, 61, 62. My two lads were as well known up there as the local lads.
So it's important to you?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Thank you very much.